folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of the discussion of the defense in that very frustrating, demoralizing season-ending loss to the Steelers, 26-24. Really feel bad for Tyler Loop in a lot of ways, a guy who had a pretty good rookie year as a kicker. Not great at extra points, but he was a slightly above the watermark, the waterline in terms of his at points added by metrics like DeVoa. I'm sure that probably changed with the missed field goal last night. Tough night for him. But we're talking about the defense here, who also had a very tough night. Joining me to do that again is Jacob Abuspitan, correct?
Much better, yeah.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it, Jake. Thanks for coming back on the show a second time and doing that. We hit on some good things, I thought, in the first episode. Some things about the amount of risk a defense needs to take in order to get results, particularly against a quarterback that is just grinding them to dust with, you know, medium range passes and the ball out quickly. There are a limited number of things they can do, but you know, you mentioned you'd have liked to see a lot more aggressive man defense.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, it, how you bring the extra pressure, or like I said, even if you're just trying to, crowd the back end of the defense, just creating a little extra pressure on the opponent when, again, not, I think the word I use essentially was not conceding, free yardage pretty much.
Okay. All right. I think everybody would like that big missed tackle game for the Ravens. We certainly talked about that and how much worse that got without Kyle Hamilton. We talked very briefly, maybe not as briefly as I was planning to, but briefly about the lost opportunity in terms of the trying to not allow the Steelers defense back on the field. There's two other pods for that might be better for you, depending on whether you want the long version or the short version of that. Look at the game recaps from last night or the post-game reaction shows. The defense played very heavy in this game. We'll probably get more into this during this episode, I would say, but they had four defensive linemen only active, and they used a lot of them on a per-play basis. They used 1.8 per play. Meant there's an extremely heavy reliance on Travis Jones. We talked about that. We talked about some of the fatigue on defense that occurred with the big loss of snap count. So I think that first episode is worth listening to. Go ahead and take a look at that on filmstudybaltimore.com or your favorite podcast platform. Now let's talk about some individual players in this part of the show. And Jacob, you've been on for the offense before, but it works the same way. Who would you like to talk about first?
I mean, you mentioned Jones, so might as well go ahead and kick it off with him. And again, like I definitely want to hear more of how you feel about it. But in my view, overall, you know, decent game considering the amount of time that he was out there. Again, he was the only one who really produced any kind of meaningful pressure, was one of the two with the sack. I noticed like one of the things that we had noted was, I mean, he led the team with five sacks in the year as well. So the kind of the issue there is that it was five sacks, you know, so that's not really a great number,
right?
But just, you know, shout out to him for, you know, at least kind of producing in a system that hasn't seemed to produce overall. But like kind of, we were saying, he was just out there all game at towards the end, you know, just, it definitely showed, but it's just one of those times you want to credit a player for, you know, putting that effort in, and you know, his future with the team, I think is definitely to look forward to, because it's been up and down, it feels like, with people, with their opinion of him. I know I wasn't as big of a fan at first, and the other guy was Broderick Washington, but the two of them I was kind of like, but Travis Jones really has kind of come out of the shell and I think been productive, you know, and I'm hoping that in the future they can kind of build off of that.
I mean, he's one of the Ravens' really two central players moving forward over the next few years, along with Hamilton. I've had Wiggins to that group as well. Wiggins is obviously a central player. We hope that Starks and Green are those. So far, they're not. Okay. But, you know, to be fair, they were rookies and they played like rookies this year. And hopefully both of them improve and play at a higher level. I think it's, you know, entirely possible and likely they will. And maybe from that sense, you want to already project them into those roles, because if they're not, it's a big problem for the Ravens. But the fact, Travis Jones is a guy that I want to be the centerpiece on the Ravens. And I think he actually gives the Ravens a lot of draft flexibility this year because they can go out and they can find a nose tackle or they can find a three tech and make an economical draft pick of an outstanding player. Maybe that a penetrating three tech, a guy that will generate a lot of pressure himself, would be certainly a lot more draft capital. And if they find a nose tackle instead, who basically is going to outlast John Jenkins within the Ravens system, so he'll be very quick, it'd be much like the relationship between Travis Jones and Michael Pierce was when Travis Jones first came into the league. He was behind Michael Pierce originally, and then all of a sudden during that 23 season, I think about midway through, that switched, and Travis Jones became the number one nose tackle, and Michael Pierce dropped the rung, and then for 24, Michael Pierce was the backup. I could see that kind of a relationship with a new nose tackle coming on that would take over for Jenkins and move Travis Jones to the three tech permanently, because I think he would be an absolute monster there, playing much more one-on-one versus guards. I mean, teams would be trying to have to figure out what kind of gimmicks they would use to get him blocked there. And of course, that's where a lot of the truly impactful pass rushers play, is they play three tech, not on the nose in the NFL.
Yeah, and I mean, and the biggest thing about that too is, I mean, modern NFL, you know, it's still a boon to have a solid nose tackle. Again, we talked about last episode to kind of eat up those running plays and take on the double teams, but it does, like you said, it gives you options. I mean, like I would personally prefer, we need to work on pressure. Like I've been a big believer that I love the idea of generating pressure through scheme, but it never beats just having someone that can be a dog and get pressure on their own. So I would like to see either someone that does permanently free him up to be that three tech, or someone that can at times be on the field with him and rotate with him to give them flexibility on the inside. But yeah, you're, like you said, you're definitely right. I mean, he does provide a lot of options for what they can do and not have to heavily invest in the interior, but there's obviously, you know, with Madueke being gone, like they're going to have to do something still, but he does free it up a lot.
I mean, they signed John Jenkins, which is a great one-year band-aid for the situation. It could even turn into, you know, another year after that, but for right now it's a one-year band-aid. That's what realistically it can be. They're probably going to double dip, I would say, in the defensive line group. They've got Urban, who's old and is probably got no more than 1 year left at the most. I would have probably laid odds he wasn't going to play this year, but he did, and he played pretty well for the Ravens, so maybe this is another time where they try and bring him back. Broderick Washington has certainly gone as a cap casualty. Madubuike, I think, I know there's people still out there who believe Madubuike is going to be back. The fact that I haven't heard anything about it scares the living bejesus out of me in terms of any possibility that he would be back. So I'm just going to assume he's not. And any kind of, if he came back and, you know, recovered to be even a portion of the player he used to be, that'd be really great.
Hey, just remember, Urban is forever. That guy, he's our generation's Jay Johnson. Just seemed to just, you know, last.
It's been exciting that they've been able to hold on to him for that long. But I double dip in the draft. Aeneas Peebles, I don't know what to think about the season he's had this year, because it's a lost season, effectively. And he's going to have to basically probably be a different player physically next year, which is he may not have the frame to carry weight exceptionally well, which may make it very difficult for him. He's going to have to get a lot stronger than other players who are larger would even have to do. It's a difficult ask, I'm afraid, of a player like that.
Yeah, I mean, speaking on just real briefly on Peebles, that's actually one that I'm not as familiar with him overall, but I know I've heard other folks talk about him, and just it's been interesting not seeing him be involved really this year, because I've heard from others that, you know, he really was someone that the coaches were into. They wanted to bring him on. Like they were, you know, on the boards wanting to bring him in. And it's just so, if that's the case, it's very interesting to kind of get your guy and then, you know, nothing happened. So right. that, yeah.
I think it was a little surprising that he didn't get some run given the fact that they'd invested the draft pick in him. But, you know, the Ravens are pretty good about completely keeping the lid on what they think about a player who's in-house. Like, the Ravens have never said anything bad about David Ajabo. And so as long as you have a good work ethic, you want to come into the building, you want to work towards being a better player, there's not going to be any coach that gets up there and says, you know, this guy sucks and whatnot. When they get salty about things, it's because somebody's got either a work ethic problem or they don't think they're completely focused on football. And an example, Glenn Cleveland was certainly an example like that, had a lot of other difficulties that have occurred. And to compound that problem, there were a lot of guys from the sideline who'd looked at scoring either on PFF or from me, and they'd see in Cleveland's limited opportunities that he'd done pretty well. And that only magnified the number of questions whenever there were any kind of questions at guard, like there have been with Bolalele and Voorhees this year, is why aren't we seeing Ben Cleveland? Why aren't we seeing Ben Cleveland? Why aren't we seeing? Well, if you're John Harbaugh, you get very tired about that question eventually, and you eventually try and short circuit it when he eventually basically kind of flared up a little bit and said, you know, in a slightly louder tone of voice, that Ben Cleveland knows what he needs to do to get on the football field. And, you know, and then he listed a couple of things, and it was like, I basically saying, I'm not going to answer any more questions about Ben Cleveland. So he did the same thing, or slightly different way, with Tim Williams when he was about to be released. He's pissed off with his work ethic, you know, as a pass rusher, and it might've had to do with special teams. There could have been multiple reasons for it, but when he starts making salty comments about a player, that player's not long for this place. And Aeneas Peebles, there hasn't been any of that. I think they are still hopeful that the guy can provide something, but he's been a situational pass rusher when he's been in there this year. It's only been a few snaps. And I don't know what future there is as a first or second round run defender. I think he may be stuck in a position and in a frame that he's only a penetrating three tech as a pass rusher. And that really limits how you can use the guy when you're playing on a team that has this tradition and longstanding set of outside linebackers who kicked inside on those downs.
What about Von Noy?
You want to talk about Van Noy now?
Yeah. How'd you feel about him?
Okay. I'll start off on Van Noy since you started off on Travis Jones. Let's do it that way. So I'm very happy with his first half. He was one of the Ravens' most dominant players, made really big plays. He had, what do you have, a pressure and let's get to it here. There were like four plays he made. He was obviously made the stop at the end of the half with Gilman, which was huge. That was his biggest play. Then he had another drive ending play where he basically dove and forced Rodgers to ground the football towards the right sideline, I think in coverage of Gainwell that was on third down. So that got him off the field. And then he had a couple other pressure events that he contributed. I'm seeing two pressure events. Both of those ended, well, one ended incomplete. The second one ended in a sack zero for Robinson, but he had the initial pressure on that play. So I thought his first half was excellent. The second half, here's my problem. The Ravens did not have very much ability to rest players at all, okay? But they did rest Van Noy. To a lesser extent, they rested Draymond Jones. And those guys, they really were depending on to be pass rushers they could get something from even as they wore on in terms of snaps. And they protected them against the run, and they put them out only on these passing situations primarily. And Van Noy in 15 snaps in the second half didn't even make my notes once. There wasn't one time where he got pressure or he made a good play on a run, or even that he's involved in any play. We have a good system for indexing our notes, which allows us to quickly, you know, get to the plays for each player we have. Another contribution from Maureen that's just been outstanding to this project over the years. But Van Noy's game bothered me from that standpoint, is that while the defense was really getting shut down in the second half, he, as a rested player, was not making a big contribution.
I don't want to delve too deep into you know, things that we don't have access to, but it has been interesting to see him kind of be at the center of a lot of, I guess, media talking points. Like it seems like because he's a veteran, you know, he's been here a couple of years now. It kind of seems like he's getting asked these questions. And I definitely it's hard because you see the effort that he made the first half. Like, you can't take away from the effort that he made the first half. But then I do sometimes wonder. I mean, it's the end of the season. The game's starting to wind down. I mean, he's obviously an older player. He's a little bit tired. And it's just, is he just beat up at that point? But like I said, they're trying to keep him fresh. I've right. always really liked him. It's just the last three weeks, I don't follow a lot of sports media, but I've somehow seen multiple, things pop up with him, like, having non-comment comments and things like that. So I do kind of wonder where, where his head is at, during the game. But I mean, like I said, he had a great first half. It's odd to see someone who seems to be so normally have that work ethic to kind of just tailor off the second half of the game.
Yeah. I don't know if I would tag him with that. He's a very mature player in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously he's an older player and he's played on, he basically knows what it means to make a championship run, but there's other things that he displays on field that are display maturity, taking accountability personally for things that have happened. I can remember one interchange between him and Trenton Simpson where he clearly was the adult in the room in terms of that. And you see that, oftentimes from older players that they don't get completely frustrated when somebody else makes a mistake, and they completely take responsibility when they make a mistake themselves. And some players don't do it. They clearly don't do it on field. You have to watch for body language in a different way from those players. Marcus Peters comes to mind of that. Mm-hmm. As a guy who there's a shoulder slumping that occurs and he just kind of walks off the field, but he's not tapping his chest and saying my bad, like other players do. Van Noy, apparently he does some stand-up comedy during the off season, which I would love to see sometime. I'd love to see him do his act at some open mic night or something. But I will tell you, when he's at the podium, he works the media that way. So you might ask a question, then he'll make a joke about somebody else who's there. That it's that kind of thing. Anyway, I can just say he's a guy's very comfortable around a microphone, and that's probably part of the reason that the media goes to him.
And let me walk it back real quick, because it's not a, I don't feel like it's a giving up. I'm almost wondering, like I said, with him and what he's gone through the last few weeks, especially if it was, like I said, if it was almost like a sense of defeat, and like I said, and just because, again, especially in that the fourth quarter, I'm touching on it only because it is strange to me to see him be that unproductive. He isn't always like, what's a good way to put it? I don't always see him like being outstanding an entire game, but mm-hmm. it's very rare. I feel like that you see stretches of him not being involved in anything. And like I said, this is definitely getting into off topic, but I just kind of curious, and I like sometimes throwing curveballs in there with questions because
sure.
he has gone through a lot with, I feel like, the last few weeks with the media and again, I mean, he might just be tired. It's the end of the season.
could be. I mean, everybody's dealing with some sort of injury right now. I mean, I would not tag it to effort. He didn't make a play in the second half. That's how I describe it. It's 15 plays. They tried to keep him fresh. And he was one of the guys the Ravens were probably relying on to make a play defensively. And there wasn't a play to be had. And he did come into this. This did not affect his play in Pittsburgh, by the way. There's no way in hell this would. But he did come into this year a little bit unhappy about not having a contract extension. And he's the sort of player at his age that there's always the risk of paying for one more year than he has productivity left. So unless you're doing it specifically as a one-year deal in a two-year contract's clothing, as they did for years with extensions for Yanda, Mason, and Reed in particular, those three players in particular, then you don't really want to mess with two-year contracts for players you think are only going to be around for 1 year. Pay them for 1 year. Pay them, what you think they're worth for that 1 year. Stretch it out with void years if you want to. but giving multiple year contracts to players in their 30s and particularly guys as old as Van Noy, who's what, 34 now, is usually a fool's errand. And so they've done a good job of generally speaking avoiding that. They just, you know, signed up John Jenkins. I mean, Jenkins is considering this an extension. Fantastic. Great for Jenkins. He's worthwhile at 2.1 years. But it's a 1-year deal for 2026. It's not a we're not talking about anything into further than that. And so that commitment is exactly the appropriate amount of time to sign him for. The only guy that I can remember recent years that they've really regretted in terms of signing for more than 1 year. I'm not talking about like Matabike where somebody gets hurt. But an older player, and I don't think they really didn't regret the additional years they had on Calais Campbell's contract at any point. I think they got real value out of that, and you know, the guy's still playing in the league. Steve Smith, maybe if you go back to him, might be a guy that they probably regretted the duration of that contract when they signed him. But they have had players that they, you know, in their 30s they signed for extra time and they became old maid contracts, but the Ravens are very sharp about that and they usually avoid those pretty effectively. Let's move on. Let's talk about another player you'd like to talk about.
So Starks, I've heard a lot of talk about Starks, obviously up and down year in a lot of aspects for this specific game. I mean, make that play, you know, acrobatic catch it would have been, you know, but definitely would have been pivotal for potentially winning the game. I think he's overall been much better. I was absolutely critical of him in the beginning of the year. I think he's vastly improved for what you would expect, you know, for a rookie. I think I do find his utilization a little bit, you know, interesting sometimes because, you know, he isn't on the field as much as I would expect him to be. But like you said, I think we noted the only target towards him was that near interception. Had some issues with tackles this game. Then we listed him as three total missed tackles, and like just kind of as I was alluding to, just not really committing to him as an every down player yet. I'm hopeful for him. I think that he does show flashes of potentially, you know, being an asset to the defense, you know, being out there. I do wonder, you know, people do talk about Orr's for all things considered, Orr's defensive scheme sometimes being a little complicated, and you know, and that might be leading to like a count for him. But I've been generally happy seeing his progression over the year. All said and done, like, wasn't a fantastic year, outstanding year by any means, but I mean, he did have a handful of picks this year, which was nice. And then two. As I said, two of them. And it's nice to see his progression, even if he's not on the field as much as I like. Again, that whole die by the sword thing. If you're spending draft capital on a rookie like that at a relatively, you know, high pick, it's just bringing in Gilman obviously was a huge difference for the defense. I just would have liked to see Starks be a little bit more involved and see, you know, how that would have maybe helped him progress even further.
The team did have the choice of taking either Gilman or Starks off the field when they were in base packages, because on base package, just to be clear to everybody, and I know you probably don't understand this, Jacob, but other people not necessarily, is you move Hamilton back off the line of scrimmage to a more typical strong safety position, not covering a slot player. Probably might not even be a slot player in the game on a lot of the packages they have base in. And you could have either Starks or Gilman on the back end of free safety. And the team has basically chosen to go with Gilman. And that's not a good thing for your first round draft pick, for that to be happening. Now, Starks has had a bad year in terms of yards per target allowed. I have to go to this right now because he actually finished a little bit strong in this one. But let me just look real quickly at how he finished the year. So if I'm using the PFF yards per target, he actually finished reasonably well in terms of his coverage grade on PFF, but his yards per target, he did actually dip down under 10 yards per target, which is nice. So he's at 370 and 40 snaps. I can do that in my head. That's 9.25 yards per snap that he's allowing. It's not great. All right. And you'd want your free safety generally to be not allowing that many. And I did look at it a few weeks ago. He's over 10 and he was one of the highest totals in the league, but that's going to be down a little bit, which probably means he's in the 25th percentile instead of the 8th percentile or something in that category. All right. But he was over 10 yards of target earlier this year. And what I tried to do in that was take out all the people who were just strong safety and only look at the guys who had at least 300 snaps at free safety. I posted that a while back on Twitter. If you maybe didn't see it, you can look through my timeline or my and try and see where I last said it. And if you miss the data and you want to see it, just DM me. I'll be happy to send it to you. I've still got it. Starks was not in a good position right then in terms of that. And unfortunately, that's exactly what we saw out of him in college. Was he had some problems with giving up some big plays. Now some of that was done in the slot. He was moved all around, you know, at Georgia, he was moved all over the place. So it's natural that mistakes would be made in the fact that he's learning multiple positions. And you know, that was Brandon Stevens was another guy who was used all over the place when he was in college, but, and, you know, probably did better to settle down at a single position as an NFL player. Starks, the need was at free safety for the Ravens this year. So they had an opening. You know, they had a first round draft pick. You're going to take your chance with that and you're going to go with it. And then they acquire Gilman mid-year and that costs Stark snaps. I mean, it's very strange.
Yeah. I mean, again, it kind of goes back to funneling through, you know, individual players with Hamilton. I mean, they did that because they had to free, you know, Hamilton up, presumably, mm-hmm. in order to, you know, utilize his skill set more. But like you said, I mean, the biggest thing is selecting Gilman over yes. him in the base packages.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's exactly it. So next year, for example, Humphrey, if he's at safety, there's no more Gilman. Gilman's out of here.
Yeah.
And it's Humphrey and Ardarius Washington are your kind of, maybe Washington is even around, right? But Humphrey is your second safety after Starks along with Hamilton. And you want to keep the same alignment where Hamilton's in the box. Is Starks going to start losing snaps to Humphrey in that case? I hope not.
I was talking to someone to go on a small tangent about Humphrey. I was very surprised. I did not realize the amount of money that they could actually make back for releasing him. So I would like, if they're going to keep him, I think obviously safety is, I agree with you, it's the way to go. But even if they do keep him and he does become a safety, I do wonder if they plan on using him more as a specialist role. I don't know if surprise would be the right word to see him replace Starks in that role for like a base defense package, but I just think they're going to turn Humphrey more into a tool for situations than potentially being out there all the time. But I could be wrong, obviously.
At $7 million, which is the on-the-margin amount the Ravens need to pay, and that's what the decision to retain Humphrey will be. $7.3 million is roughly what they save if they cut him versus if they keep him. So that's the only decision that has to be made about that. So it does not matter, and I'll read you his actual cap number because it's astronomical. His 2026 cap number is $26.3 million. It doesn't matter. That money has already been spent, all but the last $7.3 million of it. $7.3 million is the only thing the Ravens still have to decide on in terms of whether or not they want to pay it. So that's where I think you have to you could go to Humphrey and say, hey, look, we want you to cut your base salary next year by $4 million or something. And he might tell him to, you know, go stick it. I'll try and sign another team. They might really do that. Or they might try and extend him and potentially get a lower number and then not a particularly high number the next couple of years and say, hey, you're moving to safety. We see you in a more limited role. Here's what we want you to do. I don't think that exactly fits with him rebranding himself as a safety and possibly one of the top safeties in the league. I think if I were Marlon Humphrey and I'm moving to safety, I would have to want that to be potentially true. Okay, that I could become one of the best safeties in the league, and I can do it right almost right away. I'd probably just want to play on the existing 1 year of the contract, and then let the chips ride where they may after that, including, you know, the risk of retirement potentially. But you look for your next job after that year if it comes to it. I don't think I'd look for a 3 year deal with the Ravens for say $21 million. Okay. That would, you know, be, I don't know, maybe $21 million in new money. It might be realistically, if you're going to say that you're going to pay him in 27 and 28 beyond the $7 million commitment that's marginalized this year, that's on the margin this year. If you did something like that, I'm not sure it'd be all that attractive to Humphrey unless he has the Ronnie Stanley feeling, you know, desire to give a hometown discount, you know, maybe the desire to go to the Ring of Honor, that kind of thing. Humphrey is very close to earning it. Stanley certainly sealed it up with this last contract he signed and his play this year. I don't know how important that is to him.
I do, putting that aside, I actually do want to ask then, because I know you've been on the Humphrey to safety. So my concern is that it does, like, I think he can be productive as a safety, but I think he can be productive as a strong safety. I don't know how much I like him being in that free safety spot. Granted, the Ravens do kind of, you know, we have our way that they run the defense. Who knows what that's going to look like next year? But it's not even is he going to be better than Starks potentially? Should Starks have the snaps or not? I just worry about him at free safety.
So he wouldn't be at free safety. He'd be. Yeah. The strong safety or the split field safety, you can think of it. Think of it as the Geno Stone role. Okay. That he would have been playing alongside another, you know, established safety. He'd be in that split field role.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy. All made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything. Data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove. Well, he'd be on for split field snaps. And the other thing is, you can put him on there on early downs too, the same way Gilman and Starks and Hamilton play on all the big nickel snaps. You can put him on other early down snaps. It gives the defense tremendous flexibility in terms of the ability to cover for whatever Hamilton's responsibilities were when you want to rush the passer with Hamilton. That was a big thing in early in the career of DeJuan Landry, was he was a guy who empowered Rex Ryan to blitz the outside corners a fair amount in that 2006 season. He was just a rookie because he could jump right in and play cornerback in place of a guy who's blitzing the quarterback. So that's a really valuable incremental asset. I mean, he understands the defense from front to back now because he's pretty much, particularly if he moved to safety, he'd have played every position pretty much in the defensive backfield. I think he would give the defense a lot of flexibility in that role. I'm very high on the possibility of him doing it. And he's had a lousy year at corner. I mean, you got to face facts is he's PFF's lowest graded cornerback in the entire league right now in terms of coverage.
Yeah, I'm on board with it. Like I said, I'm on the same page. I think between the two of us, I probably lean more to him, again, being situational packages, things like that, more than really being out there just as a straight up, you know, deep drop safety. But let's get it. So we can definitely move on to the other person. That was one I think we could talk about all day.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. We could talk about him all day. How about Wiggins? He had a really nice bounce back game. I don't have a whole lot to say about him. Other than, you know, if you're looking for man coverage, he certainly provided it in a lot of ways in this game. Down the right sideline, he got hit in the face mask by the ball. I don't know how the official scorer in Pittsburgh or the guy who's running it for the NFL didn't award a pass defense on that play. Pass defense face mask, right? Whatever. And then he knocked down two other passes where he crossed the body. That's a real indication that you're staying with that receiver effectively. You trust your makeup speed. So really good to see him come back after the previous poor game against the Packers.
Yeah, people are so ready to jump on him after the Packers game. Like, I can't remember if it was one of your posts or not, but I was just like, look, this is – I'm not going to throw Wiggins out there as, you know, top five cornerback or anything, but he's been very well worth it. And that last game was very much a blip. Like, I don't have a lot to say – about this game either. It's just, it was solid. You know, again, I mean, most things in the secondary that we alluded to before really came down to that lack of pressure or, you know, the ball being out quick. Overall, they had a decently solid game outside of who I'm eventually going to talk about with the, you know, the final play. But yeah, it was a solid game. It was pretty much leave it at that for him.
Okay. Who would you like to talk about otherwise?
I definitely, like I said, I want to get to Wizier, but I don't mind leaving him for last just because it's not a big topic, but it's, you know, it's a nail biter one. But how about, we've really dived into the Hamilton and stuff. So how about this? How about, one guy that's kind of missed a little bit on the discussion today, only brought up briefly, was Simpson. So it's funny because, you know, we were talking about how Simpson was a lot of times taken out and from the dime so they can move Hamilton down to that will role instead. What's funny, though, is that the one of the only tackles I remember on one of the quick flats was actually Simpson. Yeah. So it is kind of funny to think about him not, you know, really being involved with the dime. And the one play that really stood out for me from him was that. It was a quick pass off to the right, and he chased it down. But
set up the fourth and one. That was the play you're talking about, the Gainwell tackle. Yeah.
But I mean, I think, you know, he's still showing that physical ability. I think I'm higher on him, very much like Starks. I'm higher than I was before, but still kind of, you know, it's obviously the guy who really blew me away this year was Buchanan, but you know, he's been out for a while. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about Simpson if you have anything additional. I know we kind of talked in a little bit and it was a mostly quiet game, but again, that was the one play that surprisingly kind of like stood out to me.
So Simpson has done, you know, decently in terms of coverage metrics when you look at him for the years. He allowed only about 5 yards per target, about 5.1 for the whole season. He's had not a great relationship between stops and missed tackles. His missed tackle is probably a little higher than you want it. Most of what has not worked for Trenton Simpson this year is knowing exactly where to be. I think he's done a pretty good job of following the play. I wouldn't trust him at all if Roquan wasn't there to be in the right place. I think it requires a little bit of hand-holding. And, you know, even though you look at something like PFF and his metrics across the board look pretty good there, he's the Ravens have a strange fascination with taking him off the field. And this occurred, of course, all of 24 was basically Simpson was awarded, I'll call it, the weak side linebacker role to start the season in his second year. And his old first year was based on but 26 or 28 snaps against the Steelers in week 18. He otherwise didn't play any, you know, with Patrick Queen and Roquan there. He didn't play at all pretty much as a rookie. But anyway, week 18, he played some in a game that where Roquan was resting and he played pretty well. And some people I talked to, one of my good friends is Jason Smith that had a lot of films. And he thought the significance of that performance against the Steelers, where he'd made about three real big splash plays during that game, was more than the value of all his time at Clemson. And I wasn't sure that I could really put that same piece on. And then, of course, he's awarded the weak side linebacker job in 2024. He promptly lost it in a staged manner. The first stage was they went from being a committed nickel team to a dime team. So they moved Kyle Hamilton in to play dime on obvious passing situation. They took him off the field. Then he started playing rotationally with Board and Harrison at that weak side linebacker spot, rotationally by series, which, by the way, that tells you competition as opposed to situational specialists kind of thing. They're rotating by series. And then all of a sudden, he's lost his job entirely to those two, who are playing a combination of outside linebacker for Malik Harrison, who's also playing inside. And you had Chris Board, who was playing on more passing downs. They obviously trusted more. They lose both of them. They sign Buchanan, but Buchanan's a rookie now, and Buchanan wins the job over Simpson. I mean, it's just we're not speaking volumes to the organization's valuation of Simpson there. Even though I would basically say that he's made some plays, he's been in the right place. His missed tackle problem has not been horrific this year by any stretch. I mean, if you live through Patrick Queen, you can certainly live through Trenton Simpson as a tackler. Let's put it that way.
Yes, that's the comparison that I often hear between the two of them. But yeah, I think you really kind of hit the nail on the head for a big part of it for me is just it doesn't seem like he makes – you know, it doesn't seem it matters when he does or doesn't make plays. It's just there doesn't seem to be that commitment for him to be out there. And I think a big part of, like you said, it does come down to a lot of the packaging that they do. They really found something that they loved with Hamilton, which is 100% understandable. And that kind of does put him in, you know, no man's land versus prior to that, as far as his usage. But I guess that's really kind of, if we're going to tie the bow on it, is, I mean, what is Simpson's, you know, role moving forward with the team? I mean, is he just destined to be regulated to depth forever, or, you know, do they move on eventually? I guess it's just,
I mean, eventually is next year. So they've got him for one more year. He's signed in his original rookie 4-year deal. So he's a, you know, still a cheap young player who has real value on special teams. I think he's a good player there. I think he's a good backup player. I don't think he's a bad backup player at all. Dog scratching at the door. I got to do something about this in a second here. But you know, I don't think he's necessarily going to take Buchanan's job next year unless Buchanan really can't go. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I've been impressed with Buchanan in a limited amount of snaps that he's had. Again, to my surprise, I really did kind of see Buchanan coming in as another Patrick Queen or, you know, another Simpson, where it's like, wow, you know, they occasionally have these splash plays, but can they do it regularly? But yeah, Simpson, it's his rookie year. Sometimes rookies kind of have that flash. And then, you know, then the following up years, it kind of just falls apart. So we'll have to see. But I do, between the two of them, I'm definitely going with Buchanan for right now. And I would stick with him for this point. But it's just it feels like an ongoing thing where I look at Owe, you know, Owe, for example, and it's just like, oh, they just like Owe spent a big portion of the year like not making sacks, but he was always one of the guys the highest in pressure.
Yep.
And it just seems like we're in this weird spot defensively, particularly, where it's like we have all these guys who are like almost feel like they're breaking out, but just doesn't ever quite get there. You know, obviously Hamilton was standing, and
Wiggins, Travis Jones was standing.
Yeah. And Wiggins is kind of on that trajectory, but it might be a lot of nostalgia. You know, I've been a fan for a long time now, and obviously you undyingly love your players as a kid and stuff like that. So it might be just being nostalgic, but it just felt like we had such a better pipeline before than we have recently. But again, that could just be that nostalgia.
I mean, they've got great players right now. They obviously they drafted the right quarterback. We'll start with that. But even beyond that, the 22 draft, for example, the load of talent they got in that one, starting with Linderbaum and Hamilton, and adding Travis Jones in round three, right, pick number 76. You know, I can't fault them for really failing to have good drafts recently. I don't think that's fair at all. But they, you know, not everybody works out either, and they've had to replace with veteran talent. I get kind of frustrated anytime that happens. But the truth of the matter is, I mean, you don't hit on a lot of Isaiah Likelys. And when they do, the Ravens are better than other teams at it. If you any kind of rigorous analysis of draft will tell you the Ravens, Steelers, and Packers are the three best drafting teams. Go back 30 years, and it's been the same guys doing it for the Ravens. So can't say they can't replicate it because they don't have the same guy there. Ozzie's right there and DaCosta right there. They've both been there in the room since the very start. And there's no reason why they can't continue to replicate the same methodology that is you know, been the cornerstone of this franchise, basically, for more years. I think any notion that Eric DaCosta should be gone is just, it's so far beyond ridiculous that I have trouble getting over it. I do wish that they would, you know, plan for the season maybe a little differently. And there are positions where I think they need to plan for more depth. Inside linebacker is not one of them. So the depth there for Simpson is kind of a surplus. It's a nice to have. The depth at safety, though, in this is absolutely critical. The depth at corner is absolutely critical and very well understood, by the way, by the organization. They haven't let us down there. They did kind of let us down this year at safety. They've let us down last year at safety in a different way because they went with some veterans who didn't work out. So Marcus Williams and Eddie Jackson are both gone, but they didn't really replace those guys with that third safety, and they end up having to trade the best pass rusher on the team to get one in the middle of the season. And that kind of flustered me a little bit. If you're talking about the management decisions they made, that was one. I respect the decision to moneyball the guard position, which is basically what that comes down to, is they made a decision, we're not going to spend at guard. We think we've got good coaching and we can make that work. And it may not have worked out. You know, obviously, Fale Lilly is going to go. I think he'll actually make some money somewhere. But, you know, the Ravens fans, at least, are perfectly happy to move on and go to the next guy. And don't be surprised if the Ravens try and do it via the draft again, and hopefully just work with a player for multiple years rather than a converted tackle that they make into a guard and doesn't have nearly as much runway, which was really the case with Fale Lele.
And then just to tie the bow on it, because I know we're trying to get through the last bit of it, but yeah, Uzie just. It's unfortunate, like, for things to end that way. I think he had outstanding season. I think he had a fine game. It's just to you know, pretty much get the revenge of Heinz Field, whatever you want to call it, terrible field, just having him slip up and pretty much be the nail in the coffin is just really unfortunate. I think he's been amazing this year, and it was one of the one things I was actually, like, really sad about this year, is to see that note end on with him, because I think he's been outstanding this year.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think he's the guy I'd love to have back. I just don't think the Ravens are going to be able to afford him. So he probably gets a 3-year deal for $25 million or something somewhere. I don't think the Ravens would be willing to invest that. So I actually look at the corner, and this is one question I was going to ask you, is how do you rank that among the Ravens' draft needs? Because I know people don't want to hear it. They want a pass rusher. They want an offensive lineman. They want a defensive lineman. That's pretty much the three positions. They want, I think, actually corner with the age of the group, potential move of Humphrey to safety, potential departure of Awuzie. I think, you know, they're going to be left with Nate Wiggins and not a whole lot of other obvious talent at that spot. And I'd really like them to try and I think they're going to need to draft a corner pretty high.
I can, the easiest way I can say is, and I'll make it very concise, is TBD DC. So, you know, that need changes drastically with if we stick into the same system or not. Like, if they can kind of not address it if something changes, but it's the one of the highest needs as long as they're sticking to the current system.
Okay. So you're okay. Fair enough. We'll have to leave it at that. We'll move on to a mailbag question or two. Prof Boggs had a question, said, I remember actually looking forward to watching the Ravens defense with McDonald and to an extent Martindale. To an extent, that's really unfair there, Prof Boggs. Does Harbaugh move on from or take a more active role in D in the defensive approach next year? And who are potential replacement candidates? You know, you bring up a really interesting point. Jacina Anderson posted something on Twitter today indicating the Ravens are likely to replace, as I take it, both coordinators. And I also would take that to mean that they're not looking to replace the head coach, who obviously didn't get fired on this Black Monday here, which I know has a lot of people bothered. I saw one tweet today. It's 5:30 and John Harbaugh is still coach of the Baltimore Ravens.
Yeah, I'm not a rabid get rid of Harbaugh person. I definitely do think he has a tremendous value and will be successful somewhere else. But I'm also a big believer in if something's stale, it's okay to change it. So I won't dive deep into it. Like, I'm fine really moving on with him because of that stale aspect, not because I think he's a bad coach. Munkin, I would take too long to touch on him, but I'm totally fine with Orr being gone, not because I just not really just dislike him. It's multiple years now where they start off terrible and then sort of recover, but not really. The most interesting I've seen out is with Stefanski being, you know, removed is, you know, what's his name? Can't remember his name now, but being Zach available. Taylor? No. What's their DC? What's their coordinator? Schwartz. For some reason, we're pinged with getting Schwartz. So I wouldn't hate it, but it'd be interesting. To go with the whole why, you know, did things look more interesting before is with Martindale. Again, it was high risk, high reward excitement. With McDonald, I mean, it generally was in a lot of way masterclass defense. And you kind of felt like you almost learned something watching what they were doing. And so that's where there's a little bit more excitement. Like the really troubling thing is that if Orr and the players could come together and work on the communication and execution of what they're trying to do, it probably would be an interesting defense as well. There just continually is a disconnect between whether it's a player not executing, whether Orr is putting someone in a bad spot. It's very much not, you know, in the like in sync at any point, it feels like.
The players are tremendously protective of Orr. So he relates very well to those players. Being an ex-player, being as young as he is, they really get along with him. And not only that, the coaches also have tremendous respect for Orr as a leader, I think. And you know, there is a little bit of a disconnect there. I think the disconnect I see more is of actual results from what's happened with the quality of talent he has and all the praise that's heaped upon him. Mm-hmm. There is a little bit of a disconnect there. I do think he's as young as he is, that he probably is still a defensive coordinator in the future in this league and possibly even a head coach at some point in this league. I'm just not 100% sure that he was ready for this role at this time. And I hate saying that. I don't think it's an obvious choice to fire him. I think it's actually a very risky choice to get rid of him. But the bar has been set so high for Ravens defensive coordinators with the quality they've had. Every one of them has been good. And even Madison, who people used to complain about all the time. I mean, the defense was probably in the top three in both of his years with the team. It's really hard to find any serious flaw with the defensive coordinators they've had. Martindale is somebody people, you know, they beat on. You really just don't understand football all that well if you don't understand why Wink Martindale's defense was good and why he got a head coaching opportunity so easily from the way the Ravens had played defense. Rex Ryan were super aggressive. All of them had something different about them. Or one of the things that's been kind of nice about it has been he's been, I think, fairly adaptable to some really horrible circumstances in terms of injury this year. And he's made, you know, some bad tasting lemonade at times out of lemons. But he's been dealt a lot of lemons this year, that's for sure. So anyway, I'm interested to see exactly how this plays out. And there's stuff going on in the castle that is very opaque to most fans and even I think most media in terms of the relationship between Harbaugh and the other coaches and the players and or Harbaugh that they don't really get. And there's no amount of little hints from tweets you're going to be able to pull together that are going to be able to make a case that's coherent about it, because players know not to talk or the Ravens will be very hard on them. And the ones who are willing to talk are the ones who have nothing to lose, nothing to lose. So it's the same thing. You put out a microphone in the village square and you put a question out there that says, is life fair? The people who are going to answer that question are not going to be the people who think life is fair. They're not going to be those people. It's the people who are upset about the situation, who want to jump up on a soapbox, scream and hold up a sign. So you're not necessarily going to get a good balanced opinion from the three or four or five guys who are willing to talk about a situation. All right, we got to move on to the last question here from John Big Booty, which, by the way, one of the all-time great Twitter handles, and he doesn't leave me any choice but to say that because his @ is the John Big Booty. So, John, how are you doing? Anyway, I appreciate your questions. I know fans are calling for coaching change, but after the D lost Kyle Hamilton and gave up points to DK-less Steelers on 4 of 5 drives, I'm more concerned with how this D is built now and going forward. One player should make or break the D in a game where injuries are so common. So he's basically talking about Hamilton. Let's keep going on this. NGL, not going to lie, I guess that is, right, NGL? It's starting to remind me a lot of the Lamar situation on O, where the team depends not only him playing well, but playing so well that it makes up for all the holes around him. Doesn't seem like a good way to build a team, but maybe trapped at this point due to where safety or dollars are allocated. Yes. You know, that's a very cogent point, John, by the way. I like a lot of that in terms of that fact. Any team with a franchise quarterback is stuck in that exact same position. So if you've got the guy, you're one of the 10 teams or 8 teams or whatever it is who really has a quarterback that's worthy of that franchise tag and is earning the huge money, then you're in that situation where you need that player to be healthy and play well. And you need him to play very well. And if it's Patrick Mahomes or Josh Allen or Lamar Jackson, I mean, just think right, like Joe Burrow, all those guys have to elevate the players around them on the team. And what would you add to that, Jacob?
I think, you know, for there's two different points to make real quickly with this is that with the defensive side, it really isn't just Hamilton. I mean, it is losing Madueke. It is not having Washington in the backfield. Darius Washington for most of the year. I mean, even again, like Broderick Washington, like you said, they're going to probably move on from, but he still, you know, he still gave something, you know, when it came to the pass rush. So the defense, I think the defense this year was probably a lot more injured than people realize. And that left Hamilton kind of being the straw on the camel's back more than anything. But I do also to an extent agree, because as I said earlier, it does seem like we run through certain players more than, again, utilizing a certain player to take just an aspect away. So there is some validity to it. Again, with the offense, I mean, there is no replacing Lamar Jackson, like for 1-to-1. I mean, for what you're asking them to do. So I don't think that, you know, there's ever going to be time to replace that. But at the same time, I mean, like the offensive line, I've been much higher on than a lot of people, but it's still undoubtedly the weakest part of the offense. And it's just, they weren't top tier opponents, although the Bears were good. Like two of our highest scoring games this year were without the Jackson. That doesn't mean you give any credence to let's replace him with Huntley or anything blatantly stupid like that. But I there is a mix of injuries, coaching errors, and just other situational things. Like the players were let down on a lot of aspects this year, but there is a specific reason that they were supposed to win the Super Bowl this year in week one. The roster, in my opinion, I fight people this all the time, was an adequate roster that we just didn't get what we were supposed to out of this year, to the fault of everybody. You know, there wasn't one particular thing. Some people may share more blame, but I don't think that this year, bar the injuries especially, we needed any one particular player to do anything. It was the mixture of everything happening that led to the results that we got.
I mean, I would agree with it probably 90% of what you're saying. The one exception to that is what Mr. Big Booty is saying here, is that they do need Lamar to play at a level which elevates all boats. He needs to be the, you know, lift the water line for the entire offense. And we did see this year when he lost his mobility, no fault of his own. I'm not blaming Lamar Jackson for getting hurt. So, you know, don't flame on me for this kind of thing. Lamar Jackson, I want him to be the starting quarterback for the Baltimore Ravens. You know, the day he is ready to hang it up and be 5 years from Canton. The difference in his play due to the lack of mobility totally changed the misdirection value of what the Ravens had on offense and totally changed their ability to grind out opponents as they have in the past. And so they didn't run as much with Jackson. They didn't take as many easy first downs as they have in the past with Jackson. Some of it is scheme. Some of it is Monken is more of a big play guy. That's true. And maybe they really need more of a hyper efficiency, keep up with the sticks offensive coordinator. You know, they're both edges of the sword. Everybody wanted to get rid of Roman because, oh, he doesn't generate any big plays. And, you know, he's just wasting Lamar Jackson's career. Look at this. Lamar's never even thrown for 4,000 yards. Well, you know, I think we've just seen Monken play. Okay, he's barely gotten over 4,000 yards now. But there's no need for Lamar Jackson to throw for 4,000 yards and the Ravens to be a fantastic football team. In fact, if Lamar Jackson were to throw for 3,500 and play every game and you do that, probably means the Ravens are having a great year. Mm-hmm. Probably means the Ravens are having a great year. So he is the guy. He is the one guy who you can't do without the health of. But I just don't. The difference maybe between Mahomes, maybe Joe Burrow, and Lamar, maybe even Josh Allen is in this group, is that the three other guys can still be very useful when a little bit hurt. And Lamar has reduced value and hurt. Just when he came back from his injuries before this last game, he just was not the same player. I mean, he had an 86 quarterback rating for an extended point period of the season after the first injury. And it's no fault of his own. Again, you know, Lamar Jackson, I don't think it bears in a whole, you know, soapboxing about this. I don't think it bears any portent for the future of Lamar Jackson that he didn't play well when he's hurt, because I think when he's healthy, he's still going to be great. And we saw it this year at both ends of the season. We just didn't see it, you know, in the middle of the year for an extended stretch there. And then, you know, it could have been the back contusion actually was something that really helped him be a little bit more right for the Steelers game. I hate to say it, but you know, they lost a game of him. They had Huntley come in and work his magic. And then we had Lamar back, and it seemed to be a more healthy Lamar against the Steelers.
Yeah. Now ultimately, I mean, he's the man. I mean, like you said, like that's what they asked him to do. He's not replaceable. Like I said, to the question, I think a lot of our players are better than I think a lot of times they get credit for, but at the end of the day, yeah, we do, for whatever reason, intentionally or not, we rely on that guy a whole bunch.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am really okay with it. They built the whole offense around him. Their entire offensive identity and the way they changed things, they changed it for him. And Harbaugh deserves a lot of credit for leaning into that. The organization deserves a lot of credit for maximizing who Lamar Jackson could be under that. But anyway, they do depend on him because of it. And a lot of the incremental value that they have over other offenses across the league is based on Lamar, you know, having his mobility and making them play 11-on-11 football instead of 10-on-11 football. All right. We got to call it here. Jacob, really appreciate you coming on. Tell folks where they can talk to you online if they want to.
Yeah, definitely. I'm mostly on Reddit. You can reach me at Spitan89, SBITAN89. But most times I'm going to drop a comment in with Ken's post. So easiest to ask any questions there, because I'm always going to be talking about whatever Ken's talking about.
All right. If you're out there on Reddit in particular, I'm always looking to meet new people for off-season pods, but for pods that might occur at any time. I roughly do 350 shows per year. Most of those include a guest, and I'd really like to have more people that I know in the Ravens community. I've got 50 people probably right now that I can call on to do a show, but it's great to meet new people. And Jacob was one of the big ones this year that's new to me and has been a lot of fun to add to the show. So if you're on Reddit in particular, where I haven't been that active until recently, please hit me up with a DM. If you'd like to be on a pod or a show or whatever, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to make, you know, some more connections on Reddit, in particular, if you have an off-season short idea. That goes for anyone out there. If you're on Twitter, just DM me. They're always open, and I'd love to hear from you. To the listeners, thanks very much. And we'll talk to you again on the offensive pod tomorrow night. Jacob, thanks again for coming on.
Always a pleasure.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.